Okay, thank you very much for having me here. So this is going to be a tutorial, and the level is aimed towards students and perhaps postdocs who might not be familiar with this area so much. So I don't know if there are any here. I see a lot of familiar faces. So for them, of course, a lot of it will be things that they are very much familiar with. So the objective in the problems I'm going to be talking about is going to be computing motion of curves in the plane or surfaces in space. So these motions arise in a variety of variational models in image processing. So today, in fact, I will review a whole bunch of them. And then we will discuss algorithms for simulating such motions. For example, motions of the following form. So normal speed might be some spatial dependent factor times curvature plus another spatially dependent factor. Or you might have a higher order evolution. So for example, here, this term comes from Willmore flow. So you have derivatives of curvature also showing up. It's a fourth order evolution. So we'll discuss some efficient algorithms for computing these motions. And we will also discuss some algorithms for finding global minimizers of the variational models we'll be looking at. So here's an outline. So today, Tuesday, I'm going to just talk about lots of problems, models, and basic facts from imaging. So in particular, I will review what image segmentation is. This is an area in imaging and computer vision where these interfacial motions arise. So here in image segmentation, contours and surfaces are the unknowns, and we'll review some very well-known models. So geodesic active contours, Mumford-Shah, and the piecewise constant Mumford-Shah model of Chen and Desai. But I will also talk about image denoising and in-painting methods, models. So in these models, the unknowns are images, so not sets or interfaces. The reason I'm going to be talking about these is because actually they turn out to be intimately related to these problems. In fact, some of these problems can be, some of the algorithms for these can be used to solve these segmentation type problems where the unknowns are contours and surfaces. So I'm going to talk about mean curvature flow, Peyronie-Malik and Geeman-Geeman energies, and the Rudin-Oscher-Fatemi model. And the overall theme will be that, of course, there are connections between segmentation and denoising models. Okay, so Wednesday, I will talk about some level set methods and their connection with PD-based globally optimal segmentation techniques. This is based on my joint work with Tony Chen and Mila Nikolova from 2005, and with Xavier Bresson and others from 2007. Thursday, I will talk about some phase field methods and very closely related diffusion-generated motion, including threshold dynamics and distance function dynamics, again, for evolving curves and surfaces under geometric motions. And so this is relatively old stuff, although when it comes to diffusion-generated motion, I will relate some more recent results as well. And Friday, I think I'm going to take the liberty to talk about some more recent research results, especially concerning extremely large-scale simulations of mean curvature motion of networks as they relate to applications in material science. Okay, so let's start by fixing some notation. I'll be talking almost exclusively about grayscale images, which will be represented by a function f defined on some rectangle omega. It will be taking its values in the unit interval 0, 1. So it represents a grayscale image. And the value of the function f tells you the brightness of the pixel found at location x. Here is the image and the function that represents it. Okay, so let's start by discussing image segmentation. So the assumption here is we have an image that depicts a scene containing several objects. And the goal of segmentation is to divide the image domain, omega, into distinct parts, regions, that contain, each of which contains a separate image. So in other words, it's a partitioning problem. You want to write the image domain, omega, which is typically a square or a cube, as a union of set sigma j, which should be disjoint, so they can only intersect through their boundaries, and they should fill up the entire volume, omega. So the assumption is that each sigma j contains an object, and of course here they're, we're saying that they are disjoint. And edges in the image, which are the boundaries of objects in the image, are going to be the union of the boundaries of these sets, of course. So we'll assume that different objects have, let's say, different color or grayscale intensity or texture. We will mostly stick with color, so that near the edges, we will assume that f, the grayscale intensity function, is either discontinuous or has very large gradient as you cross from one region into the other. So here is what image segmentation is supposed to look like. So these are hand-segmented images from a well-known database. So given an image up here on the upper left corner, we want an algorithm that would automatically divide up into regions containing distinct objects. So this picture apparently contains three distinct regions in this case. So the algorithm should say, well, in this region, there's a cat, then there's a branch, and of course, there's a background region. So how can one come up with algorithms for automatically doing that? And here are the boundaries that the human who segmented this actually came up with. So the green lines are indicating the boundaries of the objects, and they are, of course, there are places where the gradient, for example, here, the gradient of the image has a very large change. Or in the case of distinguishing the cat from the branch, of course, perhaps some texture information plays a role. Okay, so of course, image segmentation is an ill-posed problem because you have to specify the level of detail that you desire. So here's another segmentation that somebody else came up with, and this person chose to recognize the patches of this cat as distinct objects as well. So in all of the models we'll be discussing, it will be necessary to specify the level of detail that is desired. So there will be at least one parameter that tells you what level of detail you want. Okay, more examples, again from the same database. Of course, here, for instance, it's clear that more information than just grayscale intensity or large changes in the gradient of the grayscale intensity might have to be used in order to distinguish different objects here. And yet more objects. So one thing to pay attention to here is, for example, the person who segmented this scene chose to recognize this tree as an overall one region instead of going into all the details of the branches and so on. So that, of course, has to do with a scale, choice of scale in the segmentation that one desires. Okay, so having described the image segmentation problem, let's just start by reviewing one of the earliest algorithms, successful PDE-based algorithms for segmenting images, and that's the SNAKES active contours method, which was originally introduced by Kass, Witkin, and Terzopoulos back in 1992. The version I'm going to describe to you is a refinement of that due to Kichinasami, Oliver, Sapir, and Tenenbaum from 1996. As I'll describe to you, so the original version actually depended on parametrization, whereas the later refinement by these authors actually removed that, so it became an actual geometric model. So the idea is quite simple. You initialize a curve called a snake on the image domain omega, which might be a rectangle again. So it's going to be a parameterized curve, gamma of s. So let's say the parameter domain is 0 to 1, takes its values in the image domain. And then you want to prescribe a normal speed to drive it towards the edges where the regions which delineate where one object ends and another one begins. And to do that, first you define an edge indicator. So f is the given image, so you'll find its gradient, magnitude of its gradient. And basically, edges are going to be likely to be located where the magnitude of the gradient of f is large. So you define this function. So you take f and convolve it with a Gaussian. So that's to make sure that very small scale oscillations don't fool you into thinking that you might be near an edge. So you smooth it out a little bit, and then you find its gradient and the magnitude of its gradient and square it, and then you define this function, which of course becomes very small if you are near a place where f might have a very rapid transition or discontinuity. So that's why it's called the edge indicator function. It's close to zero near the edges, or it's likely to be. And then what you do is you specify a motion law for the snake, so for this curve to evolve under, and the motion law you come up with is going to be gradient descent for this energy. So this is actually nothing other than a weighted length for the curve, where the weight is given by this function. So of course, if the snake wants to decrease its weighted length, it would have to pass through locations where this weight function is small, so that drives it towards the edges. Okay, and if one does some elementary calculation, you find that the normal speed, according to decrease its fastest with respect to L2 gradient descent, is given by this law. So it involves, of course, the weight times the curvature of the curve plus an additional term that you get here. Okay, now obviously in this model of active contour snakes, you don't want to find the global minimizer because the global minimizer of this energy, of course, would be just a point or any point, right? Because then it would have just zero length. So here, in fact, you really want to look for a local minimizer. So the idea is to start your snake near or, let's say, containing an object of interest. So some level of human intervention is typically required in this model. And then you let the curve, let's say, shrink wrap around it. Or you can alternatively start your curve small in the interior of an object of interest, and you provide an expansion force. So you can say, for instance, that, well, you can calculate the area inside your curve and say that, well, the area should perhaps grow or it should be a specified value. Okay, that will contribute a certain constant to your normal speed, encouraging your curve to expand until, of course, perhaps it hits some edges so that these terms start balancing out this constant and stop your curve. Okay, so here's an example of a computation done with this method. So here's your image F, and here is the edge map, this edge indicator function that has been computed from it. Of course, there are already some choices of parameters involved here. One has to choose variance for this Gaussian. Okay. And then you end up with this. So low values of this function, okay, these dark regions are, of course, near the edges. And then you start with a curve, let's say, encapsulating, and then let it evolve, and so the curve started as basically a rectangle, and then it shrink wraps around this object of interest, which has a pretty good contrast compared to the background. So it was successful in this case. However, I should say that to make this work, this example, I pretty much spent maybe 3-4 hours tweaking parameters. So as it stated, this snake's active contours model actually doesn't work very well. So you can get a sense of why it doesn't work very well by, that's the other one. See, it's the curve almost gets stuck in the background details, and that's something that actually typically happens with this model. So actually, it's almost an unusable model as far as I know, unless there is somebody sitting in front of the computer with maybe a pen or something to help the curve along. So this is, of course, an important theme. Now, you want a local minimizer, but there are too many of them, in fact, right? So, and, you know, if you start with the curve a little bit placed in a different location and so on, there's no chance you're going to get what you wanted, okay? So it's a very, very sensitive type of model, which, of course, makes it unusable in many cases. Here, I'm looking at the situation where you start with your curve contained in the object, and then I provide an expansion force, and it grows to fill this object. Again, it's very easy for it to get fooled and get stuck in local minimizers. Of course, we will come to review some by now classical techniques for getting around this issue. Okay. Now, I really don't know what the level of detail I should go into, so I might want to actually skip these unless somebody really... So may I actually ask for a sense of if there's anybody who would benefit from discussing some basic mathematics related to these models? At least one? Anybody else? Okay, thank you. I know you won't, but let me go through it anyhow. Okay, so how does one obtain this? So what do you do? Of course, the idea is the dynamics I showed you was obtained by just writing down the gradient descent for this curve. And here's how one obtains that gradient descent with respect to the L2 inner product. You take, let's say, arc length parameterization of your curve. So let's say it's counterclockwise, oriented counterclockwise, and at time t is equal to zero, let's say you have occurring parametrization for it, then if I differentiate the parametrization with respect to arc length, I'm going to get the tangent to the curve, unit tangent, and let's call n the outward unit normal, capital N. Then, of course, here are two very basic facts. If you differentiate the unit tangent, you're going to get curvature times the normal. And if you differentiate the normal, you're going to get minus curvature times the unit tangent. And here I chose the sign of curvature so that it's actually negative for convex shapes, okay, by our convention. Then what you do is you consider a perturbation of this curve of this type. So gamma s plus scalar parameter t times scalar function phi of s multiplied by the normal field. So it's a perturbation in the direction of the normal that can vary along the curve. And then let's compute the length of this perturbed curve. You just go ahead and plug it into the usual length formula and then use the basic facts about gamma prime and the derivative of the tangent t and so on to simplify into this form. Finally, you differentiate with respect to time and set t is equal to zero, and you find out that the gradient of length of the curve is given by minus the curvature. So here we are. Okay, then you can compute this calculation with, of course, a given weight. So here this would be our weighted length term that arises in the geodesic active contours model, for example, and you go through the same kind of calculation and quickly find that the L2 gradient descent is given by this direction. So in geodesic active contours, for example, then you want to go in the direction in the opposite direction of the gradient to decrease the energy, and this is the motion law that you get, where once again this function g, the weight, is obtained from the underlying image f. Okay, so there are multiple problems with this model, as I mentioned. It gets stuck in local minimizers, and it really requires you to detect edges, which is already a very sensitive operation. Right? So the first thing you have to do is define this function, but basically this operation is detecting edges. So one of the very important advances in mathematical image processing and computer vision was models that get around the necessity of explicitly detecting edges, and Mumford-Schacht segmentation model is the preeminent example of that. So here's what Mumford and Schacht came up with as their segmentation method. So their idea is the following. You want to first find the best piecewise smooth approximation in the least square sense to a given image F. Okay, so to do that, to find the best piecewise smooth approximation, they propose minimizing the following energy. Now, the idea is if you had a piecewise smooth image, it would be very easy to recognize where the edges are. So if you had no oscillations coming from texture or anything, then you could easily detect where the edges are by looking for discontinuity points of the function grayscale intensity. Of course, a given image f is not going to be of that form, so what you do is you first find a piecewise smooth approximation to it, so u, and the way you do it is by minimizing this energy. So let's go through the terms in the energy. First of all, the unknowns are twofold. U of x is a piecewise smooth approximation to the image f. It's going to be smooth except across the set of discontinuities k, which is also part of the unknown, and there's a parameter lambda which still acts as the scale parameter that I mentioned in the hand-segmented images that I showed you. So you're basically supposed to minimize its energy. So the first term is basically the Dirichlet energy in the regions defined by omega minus this set of discontinuities. And then, so that forces, of course, the function u to look smooth when you're away from the set of edges k that you're allowed to exclude. Then there's a term which is the length of the segmentation, discontinuity set k, which prevents over-segmentation. We'll come to that in a second. And of course, this is forcing you, right, your piecewise smooth approximation, to look like the original image f. Okay, so once again, so this term, the first term in the energy, ensures smoothness away from the edges. Length of k prevents over-segmentation and allows you to select the scale, the level of detail of the segmentation. And of course, you have the fidelity term to ensure approximation of the given image. So the advantages are there is no explicit edge detection needed. It does not require presence of prominent transitions in the image F. So even, for example, when you're given a very blurry image F that doesn't have any locations where the gradient is very large, this method can still find reasonable segmentation by finding edges, and it's very robust with respect to noise. Okay, so this is an explanation of why you need the penalty on the length of the set K, right? So K is supposed to be basically a collection of curves. If you don't include length of K as a term in your energy, so here I omitted it, then the functional can be trivially minimized, right? Because then you will say, choose, for example, the set of set K to be the union of these red lines, and omega then would be the complement. So these little squares define the complement of those red lines. And then I can, given an image like this, any image in L2, of course, I can approximate it arbitrarily closely by a piecewise constant image, which happens to be constant in each one of these squares. So the fidelity term can be made very, very small by taking lots of very small squares here and getting a very fine approximation, piecewise constant approximation. And inside each one of the squares, the function u is going to be constant, so you're not going to get any contribution from this term. And of course, you're not paying any penalty for the length of these red lines, so you can have as many of them as you like. So the infimum is going to be just zero, and it's a useless functional to minimize. That's why it's necessary to put some level of penalty, at least, on these curves. Now, I should mention that this full generality of Mumford-Schaach is actually very hard to minimize, and I really don't know any method that's particularly good. Okay. So here I use one of the most popular and actually old methods. I'll tell you about it. This is the Ambrosio and Tortorelli's approximation using phase field. On the left you see the given image F, and on the right I'm showing you the piecewise smooth approximation that was found by this technique. It's one of the best techniques I know for minimizing it, but otherwise it's too ambitious, too hard a method for segmenting images. You can see that this piecewise smooth approximation still has discontinuities in it. Of course, for example, here this will be part of the discontinuity set K that was found. Okay, now you can consider the limit now where we are scaling these parameters lambda and mu in the following way. Okay, so what that means is, in fact, so this Dirichlet energy term becomes more and more important compared to the second and the third terms, okay? Because both mu and lambda are becoming small at the same rate as epsilon goes to zero, while this term is going to be still as order one as a constant in front of it. Then what that does is it forces the gradient of the piecewise smooth image to be very close to zero, okay, inside omega minus k. What that means is, in fact, u is forced to be piecewise constant, and we get a special case of the Mumford-Schaach model that is most often used. So this piecewise smooth Mumford-Schaach that we've been looking at over here allows the function u to be really smoothly varying away from the edges, that turns out to be very difficult. In particular, it allows for open curves and very complicated collection union of open curves as the minimizer for K. But if you consider this limit and force U to be essentially constant in omega minus K, then you get piecewise constant U, and your discontinuity set K is then going to be much nicer. It's going to be boundaries of sets, okay, fat sets. So things simplify considerably, and you end up with a much, much simpler model, which is still challenging, but it's much easier. So now what you're doing is, so sigma j, okay, are going to be the regions in which this function u takes on a constant value. Okay? So you can prove, actually, that this function can take only a finitely many, okay, the minimizer can only take finitely many constant values. So there's going to be only finitely many sigma j's given this parameter alpha. And in each one of these sigma j's, the minimizer is going to take a certain constant value. And then this term here, length of k that is continuous to set, just becomes the length of the boundaries of the set sigma j summed together. And this fidelity term, of course, becomes this term. Okay, cj is the constant value that f takes in sigma j. Okay, so if you take that and stick it into here, just write f as, you know, in terms of the value sigma j, cj that it takes in each sigma j, then this fidelity term becomes this one. And even though a priori you put no bound on the number of regions, it turns out that the minimizer will always prefer to have a finite number of regions. Then you're basically forced to carry out this minimization, which is over set sigma j and the constant cj. Okay, and in fact, Chen and Vesey back in 2000 considered this version of Mumford-Shah and came up with even more simplified version of it. What they did is they said, well, let's just prescribe an upper bound on the number of the regions anyhow. We know that it's going to be bounded anyway. So let's just say, for example, let's look at the simplest case. They said, well, let's just minimize this Mumford-Shah in the case where the piecewise smooth approximation is actually piecewise constant and can only take two constant values, c1 and c2. So given an image f, you're trying to approximate it by a function that can only take two values, c1 and c2. The unknowns are what those two constant values are, c1 and c2, and also where they are taken. So let's call the region in which u is equal to the second value, c2, let's call that sigma. Then, of course, the rest is going to be omega minus sigma. In omega minus sigma, u is going to be just equal to c1. So, of course, any such function u of x can be written in this form, c1 times the characteristic function of sigma plus c2 times characteristic function or complement of sigma. I hope I got it right. Maybe it switched. Anyway, doesn't matter. So if you take this and substitute it into the Mumford-Shah energy, then the discontinuity set, of course, is just going to be equal to the boundary of sigma because the value jumps from c1 to c2 as you cross it. This term, of course, is going to be zero because u is constant in each one of these regions defined by sigma. Okay. Length term, length of the boundaries, the discontinuity set, is just going to be the perimeter of sigma, and the fidelity term simplifies in this form. Okay. And the energy, therefore, the Mumford-Shah energy, becomes, when you restrict it to piecewise constant functions, taking only two values, it just becomes this very simple form. So perimeter of sigma plus the fidelity term, basically, written in terms of the unknown set sigma and the two constant values c1 and c2. So how can we minimize such energies? Well, you make an initial guess for the boundary sigma, and then you update the boundary sigma so that the energy decreases as fast as possible. So, for example, you can try to do a gradient descent, which leads to solving a PDE describing the motion of sigma. And here are some examples. So in this example, for instance, I started with square as the boundary of sigma. So sigma is the interior of the square, and the constant c1 and c2 values were updated each time I update the curve. The fact that you have, of course, perimeter of sigma appearing in your energy means when you do gradient descent with respect to L2 inner product, you're going to see a curvature motion showing up. So that encourages the curve to shrink and wrap around this object, even though this object doesn't have a sharp discontinuity that is very clear in it. The model nevertheless finds what acts as some sort of a perceptual boundary. Okay, so here's another example. I'm sorry, the curve is oscillating. That's because of my video converter. Otherwise, it doesn't really oscillate under this dynamics. And of course, we want to discuss some numerical methods that will allow the curve, for instance, to change topology and so on as it shrinks, because this happens all the time when you try to apply these methods natural images. Okay. Here's another example where the parameter lambda was chosen larger. So lambda, once again, I will go back and show you, is the parameter in front of the fidelity term that allows you to choose a scale. If lambda is very large, then the perimeter of sigma isn't so important, so you're allowed to use a longer curve to segment the image better. Okay, so that allows you to capture more details, as we saw in the second example. Anyway. Okay, here are some more examples. So this is an important example to look at because the earlier methods, of course, for minimizing Mumford-Shah, even the piecewise constant Mumford-Shah, got really fooled by these issues. So you start with a curve, And here, what it should really do is segment out these objects from the background. But in order to do that, it has to change topology and split into several connected components. Okay, that's already fooled some numerical methods. So for example, front tracking and so on. You cannot explicitly represent this curve by a parameterization and allow it, expect it to find these connected components. But even more difficult is the fact that it actually had to somehow find an interior contour. That requires not just splitting off on by changing topology, where the curve, okay, so the curve can touch itself and break into little pieces. There are a whole bunch of numerical methods that will allow you to do that. But this method that I use to do this actually allows the curve to nucleate new connected components. Okay. So how does one go about doing that? All right, so here are some more examples. This is a square. It broke up into several pieces to find these objects. Here, the value of lambda was smaller. Therefore, you're not allowed to use as much of as long of a curve to segment it. So you get a much coarser segmentation. So the pen is lost in particular, and so on. Okay, so let's just run through very quickly. How does one derive at least the motion law for the piecewise constant Monfort-Schwarz segmentation? Well, we saw that perimeter is part of that energy, so we already know that that leads to curvature motion. The additional terms in the piecewise constant Monfort-Schwarz are bulk energy terms, so they are of this form. So your unknown is the set sigma, and you're minimizing a term of this form, so integral of a function b, which we will assume is given to us, over the set sigma. So when you do gradient descent with respect to L2 inner product for a term like this with respect to the set sigma, what kind of contribution to the normal speed do you get? Again, it's a very easy calculation. You perturb your curve once again in the normal direction, okay, by this term. And then this time you choose a parameterization for this perturbation to the set that is induced by the perturbation to the curve, so the boundary. Okay, so it's going to involve two parameters, of course. So one of them is the parameter for the curve, okay, plus how much you move in the normal direction. Okay. That would be parameterization for this region here, where S ranges over 0 to L and C ranges from 0 to T, how far you go in that direction. Anyway, it's a very elementary calculation that will be on the slides anyhow, so you can review it if you like the details. So you pull back to the parameter domain, etc. Right? So do some very simple calculus, and you see that the contribution, so the gradient of a term like this, so gradient of this term with respect to the set sigma is going to be given by the integrand b. Yeah. So when you take those two pieces of information, so curvature coming from this term and what we saw coming from these two terms, then you find out that the normal speed of a curve that, let's say, wants to minimize the Monfort-Schwarz, piecewise constant Monfort-Schwarz energy written here as fast as possible is going to be given by this expression. So curvature plus a term, spatially depending term that depends on the underlying image and the two constants you are using to approximate the image. Okay. Now, in the remaining time, I want to talk about one other model. For the reason that it's actually, so I should say this model in practice doesn't get used, I should also say, okay? But it's a good way to motivate another class of geometric motions, namely high order motions. Okay, this is the original place in which fourth order flows arise in computer vision, and it's the model that was proposed by Monfort, Nitzberg, and Shiota. So let me explain to you quickly what it's about. So suppose you're given a 2D picture of a scene with various objects in it, just like in the segmentation case. Okay. Now your goal is to determine automatically the shapes, the relative nearness of the object to the observer, and their occlusion relations. So suppose you're given a picture like this on the left-hand side. Not only do you want to recognize regions where that contain different objects, but in fact, here you're assuming that this is a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional scene containing two different objects, and you want to make an inference of the following type automatically. This, when I look at this scene, I don't think that it consists of a gray disk and a black crescent that happens to be right next to it. What I'm led to think, my visual system is led to think, is that this scene actually comes from a three-dimensional scene in which there is a gray disk and a black disk. The black disk is behind the gray disk, partially occluded by it, and this is what I see when I look at it. So Mumford, Nisberg, and Schroeder wanted to write down a model that would actually take this two-dimensional image and infer a three-dimensional conclusion from it, like the one on the right-hand side. So, of course, this all relies on our visual system having some prejudices. We prefer, okay, so the key point here is, we prefer our visual system, so some people argue, prefers low curvature boundaries of objects. So if you try to recognize this as consisting of a gray disk and a black crescent, the boundary of black crescent, you see, makes very sharp turns at these two corners. And our visual system dislikes that and says that, well, that's not likely to happen. I prefer to believe that the real boundary of the black disk is smooth. But if it's smooth, then it would run into this gray disk. The fact that I don't see it do that must mean that the black curve is behind the gray disk and is therefore being occluded by it. So supposedly, this is how our visual system comes to the conclusion. And Mumford, Nisberg, and Schroeder wanted to come up with an algorithm, a model, that would capture this and this notion, and that leads to curvature-dependent functionals. So you basically want to penalize contours, not only their length, okay, but also something a little bit higher order. You want to say, well, okay, if I reflect this part, right, it will complete it into a nice disk, the length wouldn't change, but actually if you, for example, look at the square of the curvature integrated around the boundary, that will go down dramatically. Okay. So here's what their model looks like. When you look at a three-dimensional image like this, you assume that it came from looking from the above, okay, on a bunch of planes parallel to themselves, to each other, right, containing distinct objects, right? So a vertical bar, horizontal bar, and a disk at the bottom, right? If I look from the above, right, I will see this two-dimensional projection. Mumford, Nisberg, and Schroeder want to be able to reverse this arrow automatically, right? So you give this single two-dimensional picture, it should produce these three planes with regions, some objects painted into them. Okay, so the strategy is again to exhibit the solution as a minimizer of some energy. The unknowns are going to be the number of objects, the regions that they occupy, and the approximate color of each object. But now, so it's exactly like segmentation, because you're looking for regions, a partitioning of the domain, but these objects can occlude each other, therefore they're not required to be disjoint. The sets are not required to be disjoint. However, we'll say that if J is bigger than I, then sigma J is going to be, by definition, in front of sigma I. Okay? So sigma J can occlude sigma I, but sigma I cannot occlude sigma J. And then for any given region, sigma I, you can define the visible part of sigma I by saying, well, I take sigma I and subtract from it all the objects that are in front of it, right? Then what I end up with is going to be actually the visible part of that object. And Ki is going to be the curvature of not just the visible part of the object, but the full boundary. Okay, so the energy that Nisberg, Mumford, and Schroeder came up with is the following. So there is a penalty on the boundary of sets, again, but in the original Mumford-Schach model, that penalty would be just integral of 1, integrated with respect to arc length, over the boundary of the ith region. Here, however, they're not just integrating 1, right? They're integrating 1 plus, so you're going to still get some length, okay, of the boundary, plus a function of the curvature of the boundary. And this function phi is, they say, it should look like this. It should look like a parabola for small values of its argument, and it should have linear growth at infinity. Okay? It should be positive, even, C2 convex. Okay. All right. So what's the point of doing this? The point is, of course, to prevent very sharp turns. If you have a corner, for example, then this term is going to induce. So if phi, for example, looked like a parabola everywhere, then you cannot have a corner, because then the curvature would not be square integrable. Okay. This model, because phi has linear growth at infinity, it will allow corners, but it will penalize them a lot. Okay. So again, so length term means regions should be simple. Curvature term means edge contours should have a tendency to continue straight, not make sharp turns. And then you have a fidelity term, which represents the image that you see in terms of the visible parts of the objects and the colors that they have. So that's where this is coming from. And so let's just try to understand at a very intuitive level what this curvature dependence tells us. So for example, when you look at an object like this, right? Suppose this is the top object and this is the bottom object, then fidelity term, right, for the bottom object is going to be inactive in this region, which allows you to continue the contour of this pieces of the curve into this region. So if you look at this, if you look at this image, Mumford and Shah would say, well, the boundaries here are, well, I have this boundary and this boundary, plus these horizontal boundaries. But now, Nisberg-Mumford-Shota model allows you to do the following. Okay, that's one of the possibilities. Maybe I have these boundaries and the horizontal boundaries, but it also allows you to say, well, perhaps the boundary of the first object, okay, are these two vertical boundaries. So the first object would be the entire connected bar, but I'm not seeing that part, right? But the model allows you to not see that part because it says, you know, it allows you to assume that this vertical bar is actually partially occluded. So the fact that you, in your minimizer, let's say, you find that this two pieces are connected into a single object doesn't hurt the fidelity term because the function is arranged so that only the visible part of the objects contribute to the fidelity term. Okay, and which one would you prefer? Of course, the functional ends up preferring this explanation because if I took these to be my boundaries, then I would pay very large penalties from the curvature terms at these corners. Whereas if I continue the boundary straight, of course, then I don't pay anything for curvature. Okay, here is a sample calculation. Original image, very simple. Here are two regions taken as initial guess. So you minimize this functional, and what you end up with is that even though our initial guess was like this for the object, right? So here my order guess is that, let's say, this is behind, this is in front, right? I minimize with respect to that assumption, and I find that, in fact, those pieces connect up to give me this this fork. If I make the other assumption that actually the broken fork was in front and the bar was in the back and minimized, then fidelity terms prevent me from making this connection and decreasing the curvature terms. So I find a minimum energy of 41 in this case, a minimum energy of 29 in this case. So you say, oh, okay, then the order guess AB, which says that the bar is in front of the broken fork, must have been the correct one. So that's why, that's how you end up with a conclusion concerning the three-dimensional arrangement of the objects from a single two-dimensional picture. Okay. At least that's what happens in principle. So in practice, this is too hard. Okay, so actually, as far as I know, the model, as it's stated here, doesn't really get used, okay, in segmentation. But it has inspired many other models in image processing. For example, in image inpainting. Okay, so I'll try to say something about that application too, if we have time. Okay, but now, of course, let me just go over and emphasize that these models that we have discussed, where the unknowns are actually sets and boundaries of sets, they're actually very closely connected with image denoising models, some image denoising models, where the unknowns are actually functions. Okay, because unknowns are functions, these models are typically easier to minimize, right? Because sets are harder to parameterize and minimize over than functions. And as we will see, in fact, some of the segmentation models over sets can be relaxed into some of these image denoising models. Okay. So I'll have to go through this very quickly, but it's very elementary anyway. So historically, this is how image denoising, PDs and image denoising showed up. The first idea of electrical engineers a long time ago was to do the following. If you have a noisy image F, to denoise it, you convolve with a Gaussian, you do a local averaging, and you get a blurry picture that doesn't have a lot of the oscillation. Okay. That is, of course, equivalent to solving the heat equation with the given image F as your initial data. Okay. So what this does is it suppresses oscillations, which is good, but it also blurs discontinuities, edges in the image, which is bad. And it generates a one-parameter family of gradually simplifying images, right? So that one parameter is the time t that you stop at. Okay. So here is the heat equation blurring an image. As time goes on, of course, it becomes blurrier and blurrier. For a certain application, you might have to choose your time value in a judicious way. Okay. And so here is, for example, I chose a reasonable time value here. The oscillations, the noise is gone, but of course the image became very blurry. Okay, the next idea people came up with was, look, if we just diffuse the image with the heat equation, that blurs the edges. So why don't we try to find a version, a sort of diffusion which doesn't blur the edges. So here's what the idea was. At an edge, of course, the gradient is going to be pointing perpendicular to the edge. So you can say at any point in the image, I want to diffuse along the direction that is perpendicular to the gradient and not in the gradient direction. So given the Laplacian, of course, you can write it in two terms, diffusion with respect to some vector c and diffusion unit vector c and diffusion in the perpendicular vector to c, okay, this form. And you can choose xi and eta in any way you want. That's a very simple fact about the Laplacian. So in particular, at each point x, I can choose xi to be the gradient direction and eta to be the perpendicular gradient direction. Then if I drop the diffusion in the gradient direction, right, so this term is gone, I just keep this term where eta is the direction that's perpendicular to the gradient, then in fact we end up with motion by mean curvature of level sets of u. Okay, so ut is equal to grad u times divergence of grad u over norm grad u. This term, the second term, is actually the curvature, or more generally, mean curvature of the level sets of u. Okay, so here's a simple calculation which I will have to skip, which shows you that under this dynamics, actually level sets of the function f evolve according to curvature motion. And this is what it looks like. Okay, so this is a very, naive implementation of this flow. There are better versions around, but it looks more or less something like this. So you see that even at later times, you can have what looks like sharp discontinuities in your image. Okay. So for instance, for a certain stopping time, maybe you take this image and turn it into something like this. So the oscillations are gone. You kept some of the boundaries sharp. It still doesn't look great, but it's better than the heat equation, that's for sure. Okay. So then eventually people said, well, let's go even further. Okay, why just stop at inhibiting diffusion in the direction of the gradient? Reverse the diffusion in the direction of the gradient. Try to generate sharp boundaries even when they're not there. So that led to the following type of equation. Ut is equal to divergence of, here you have a weight that depends on, so a diffusion coefficient, right? You have a diffusion coefficient that depends on the gradient of the function, where you take g to be something like this. So when x is large, when its argument is large, right, this becomes very small. Okay? And if it becomes small as fast as this function, for instance, when you expand this diffusion constant out, you find out that indeed for for large enough values of the gradient, it becomes backwards diffusion. Okay? So you can once again write this in terms of diffusion in the direction of the gradient and diffusion in the direction perpendicular to the gradient. And you find out that if you choose, for example, your function g to be this, then in fact the coefficient of diffusion in the direction of the gradient becomes negative. Okay, so that leads us to the Perelman-Malik model, which might have been actually one of the earliest nonlinear PDEs that was proposed in image processing. So here's what it looks like. The function g is the one that I showed you before. Typically, it's not implemented in this form. You instead you look at the one-dimensional version and add on just the, let's say the x direction, and then you just add on the same term in the y direction, which isn't precisely this one. It's a little bit more anisotropic version, but that's what people usually use. Now, if you work out what this function r is, it turns out to be xi times g of xi squared. So for the nonlinearity g I showed you, it would be xi over 1 plus xi squared. And what you see is, it has this form, r has this behavior. It's increasing for a while for small values of its argument, but then becomes decreasing for larger values. That's what leads to the backwards diffusion, in fact. And here is what it does on an image. So it actually turns it into some image, the given image, into something that looks pretty much piecewise smooth, okay, in a gradual fashion. Okay, and this is in fact one of the first instances of we can make a connection between image denoising models and image segmentation models, because in fact Perelman-Malik is, you can rigorously show that it's a technique for solving the full Mansur-Shah, Okay, so it was one of the earliest methods for doing it. So let me just explain that connection. Look at this paranormalic scheme that I wrote down. Okay, then it's going to be L2 gradient descent for an energy. Okay, so based on R, the nonlinearity R, you can work out what psi corresponds to it. It's going to be the integral of R. Okay, and the integrand, okay, so the energy density has this psi, okay, has this form. So it's convex for small values of its argument and becomes concave for larger values. Okay. So in this case, for example, psi looks like log 1 plus c squared. Okay. So this concavity is, of course, when you're trying to minimize a function, a concave function of the gradients, that's what leads to the ill-posedness. Okay. But here is something to say. Now, don't take this complicated psi, okay? The main thing here is that it's convex and then it becomes concave for large values, okay? Here is something that looks pretty much like that, okay? So let's take our psi to be a parabola for small values, and then let's make it constant from a point onwards, okay? And I'm going to choose that transition point carefully. That transition point should be related to, okay, now h, okay? So you have to discretize this thing on a grid. Okay, and h is going to be your delta x, the size of your grid. And if you put that transition point between the convex and the concave, well, so the flat regions, in the correct place, corresponding to your grid size, then, in fact, you realize that what you end up with, the energy that paranormally comes from, is actually the very well-known, even earlier model for image segmentation due to Gibbon and Giemann. So, and Blake and Zisserman. So this is the weak springs model, which unfortunately we don't have time to get into. But the upshot is the following. If you take in these energies, okay, so basically the paranormalic model is a gradient descent for this energy. If you take in these energies, if you scale that transition between the convex and the concave regions, okay, in the correct way with respect to your grid size, in fact, those energies converge in a very very precise sense, in the gamma convergence sense, to the full piecewise smooth Mumford-Sharp model. And so, in fact, this denoising model of paranormalic turns out to be an image segmentation model. And of course, it's very difficult to minimize because of non-convex. Yeah? Oh, yes. So, gamma convergence proven by Antonin Chambol in 1996, long time ago. Okay, so what if you take these energy densities to be, again, more like the original paranormalic, right? You make it convex and then concave, but with some growth at infinity, not just constant. Well, it depends on how fast it grows. So, for example, if you take it to have some power law growth at infinity, P, where P, okay, P over 2, P will have to be between 0 and 1 so that you get you're in the concave region, right? Then you don't precisely get Mumford-Sharp, but you get something like Mumford-Sharp. So instead of measuring just the length of the discontinuity set, you integrate the jump in the function u, a function of the jump over the function u over the discontinuity set. Okay, so these can also be proven rigorously. So paranormality turns out to be gradient descent for Mumford-Sharp type models. And people use this. This is one of the, I guess, most usable ways of attempting to minimize the full Mumford-Sharp model, the piecewise smooth one. Although, of course, because of all the non-convexity, it's very difficult to minimize something like this. So it can get stuck in local minimizes and so on. So one of the earliest ideas for trying to do this numerically was to start with a almost convex psi, minimize it, and then take that as the initial condition for a minimization where psi is made slightly less convex and so on. You do a continuation like this. That's called graduated non-convexity method. There might, of course, be better methods around, but this was one of the first things that was tried. Okay, now, more important for us is going to be the Rudin-Oshel-Fortemi model, which I will discuss in detail maybe next time. Okay, I think I have to stop here. Thank you. Yeah.
So in a certain sense,
it's kind of closer to the exactly. Yeah. So for example, if we take P to be equal to 1, right?
Okay.
Push it,
okay.
Then you're just going to get exactly total variation.
Right. Okay. And,
a good point. Thanks for pointing out. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're unreliable. That's all I know. But I would think so. Yes. I'm being recorded, right? But anyway. but my understanding is that they can get stuck in local minimizers. I mean, it depends on how you do it. There are a lot of parameters involved in doing a graduated non-convex, right? How fast do you? I mean. I don't know actually. Yeah. I mean, you would have to be very precise about, you know, going from, you know, one of those nonlinearities to the next one. I mean, how close they have to be, and so on. You would have to be extremely precise about that to make sure that you end up in a local minimizer, I suppose. Anyway, that sounds like a very weak statement to that you end up in a local minimizer anyway. I mean, there are so many local minimizers that, you know, is that a reason? Really?
Yeah.
Sure, then it's more local, of course. You don't want the global minimizer, sure.
You're happy with a local minimizer,
sure.
And any algorithm that provides you a very nice algorithm that
thanks
you a good one.
Right.
And, yeah, but I wanted to understand how robust these other algorithms are.
But yeah, so they've been around for... Yeah, they've been around for a long time. I would assume that people have a pretty good understanding of how good they are by now, but I was always under the impression that you have to tweak them a lot and, you know, maybe... right. Okay. Yeah. One more? Yes. Oh, right. You need to still add the fidelity term. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part is how do you get length coming out of, and, you know, the Dirichlet energy away from discontinuities and the length of the discontinuity set. How does that pop out, right? You have to, so, all right. I would have to add here the fidelity term, okay? So you can imagine that this is the Mumford-Schaff flow or something, right? So, okay. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I didn't have time, but it's a very simple calculation to intuitively understand why, you know, you get those two terms. Yeah.
Okay. Let us get confused about the problem of the present global minima, because in one dimension, you're right, and like the function is locally convex, but then this is not so bad because it's like.
Yeah, so right. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So that's the energy density that is has that property. The functional itself, as a function of their u, is not quasi-concave, okay? Quasi-convex. So in fact, you can have many, many local minimizers, okay? So, unfortunately, it's not so simple, yeah. Yeah?
What's the definition of the model?
Well, this is one of them. Is this, or go back further to, oh yeah, here.
So,
yeah.
G, as you see, can satisfy certain conditions of the hardware. Is this implemented for all functions, or specifically, like, on general?
No, no. G has to go down to zero, I suppose, fast enough. You can work this out. But, you know, you could put total variation flow in this form too, right? And that's not what you proposed, right? So,
the other functional G is not always R actually, but you mean this one you said that gets stuck in the
memory? Oh, no. So, sorry. So, it's not a parabolic PD. It becomes backwards parabolic. So, there is no existence theory for it. Complete existence theory doesn't exist for it. So it's very sensitive to initial data, for instance. So now, if you try to solve backwards seed equation, right, you would expect a disaster immediately, right? Now, that doesn't happen. You don't see disaster with this. In fact, if you write down a standard finite difference of discretization for this, at least for the one-dimensional formula I showed you, right, you can show very easily that it's total variation diminishing. So it doesn't generate oscillations, for instance. It satisfies some form of a maximum principle. So you don't have a comparison principle, but you know certain maximum and the minimum will not, of the initial data will not be exceeded. So it behaves better than you might expect from a backwards diffusion equation. Nevertheless, there is no getting around the fact that it will be extremely, I mean, when you discretize it, right, it will be extremely sensitive to perturbations in the initial data. So tiny perturbation will lead to diverging solutions. And that's the reason for its impulsiveness. It is, of course, connected with the concavity and so on of the energy that is involved, right, which is also responsible for local minimizers and so on. Right?